net for optical field sensing by error seconds tracking. So obviously, this new solid-state device doesn't require any vacuum, any complicated stuff, very small thing. Obviously, is able to sample the ultra-fast, really ultra-fast, hyper-fast oscillations of the electric field, of infrared, and even visible, and actually, since very recently, even UV light. The measurement of oscillating light fields with this simplified attosecond metrology now provides a new probe for attosecond phenomena, and this is the electric field of light varying on an attosecond time scale. Thanks to the fact that we can precisely measure this now, we can use this as a probe. Actually, we can use it also for controlling, steering the processes, but I'm now going to focus on its application for using it as a probe. How does this probing happen? You will see in a moment. Actually, this very quantity, the electric field of light, directly probes the most fundamental process, the most fundamental consequence of any light-matter interaction, the displacement of electronic charge density, briefly polarization induced by light. This polarization response is imprinted in the electric field transmitted through the sample. Referencing this transmitted field to the input field, we can measure both of them. We have now a simple tool for doing so. Referencing this transmitted field to the input field allows for a thin medium, unambiguous retrieval of the induced polarization. Along with its driving field, this polarization defines the instantaneous energy flow between light and matter. This very process naturally, genuinely occurs on a time scale determined actually by the oscillation period of the electromagnetic wave that is driving the process, which is, for visible light, at the second time scale. Here I show you how this energy transfer occurs in an insulator and a semiconductor subjected to a strong laser field. For the highest fields applicable below the damage threshold, almost all of the transferred energy is deposited irreversibly by creating a conduction band population via microphoton transitions in both materials. In the silicon case, we need for this 0.7 volt per angstrom. In the case of the much bigger band gap of quartz, the field strength has to be cranked up quite a bit, very close actually to damage threshold, even for these very short pulses, 2.7 volt per angstrom. What happens here actually, the field is promoting electrons from the valence to the conduction band, which of course cannot be reversed by the field. That's why I said that basically the process is irreversible from the point of view of the laser field, right? These carriers live there quite a bit longer than this few cycle of the laser pipe. If we now successively reduce the incident laser electric field, the behavior in the two materials is distinctly different. In the case of the six photon band gap, the irreversible part of the energy transfer rapidly decreases. It scales with the sixth power of the intensity, leaving the optical curve back induced energy exchange behind. This is the yellow curve on the left hand side, which is fully reversible by the field, and hence it is ideal for ultra-fast dissipation-free signal processing. By sharp contrast, this does not happen for the two-photon band gap, where reactive and dissipative part of the nonlinearity has the same intensity scale, and hence the two processes always appear in combination. This study showcase how real-time access to the energy flow between light and matter will be instrumental in exploring the optimal interaction regimes for multi-terahertz to petahertz signal processors. Multi-photon interval transitions get ever faster for increasing bandwidth. That's what you see here from a series of measurements on materials with different bandgap, silicon, diamond, quartz, where two photons, four photons, and six photons were needed to actually overcome the energy barrier between the valence and conduction. For quartz, with a bandgap of about 10 electron volts, the resultant carrier injection is substantially confined to less than 500 attoseconds, as you see on the right-hand side. This is actually what underlies the petahertz bandwidth of nonlinear photoconductive sample. This is the process that injects the carrier. So you see that the carrier injection is substantially happening within this rise time, basically within about 500. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I'm speeding up a bit. Sub-femtosecond carrier injection offers more than field sampling. In combination with the petahertz bandwidth field metrology, it allows also versatile sub-femtosecond control and interrogation of carrier dynamics in bandgap materials. This interrogation performed by Markus Ossiander and Martin Schulze has recently enabled us to explore the fundamental speed limit of electron-based signal processing by evaluating the highest frequency at which the electric current responds linearly to the applied external field, which turned out to be of the order of 1 petahertz. This frequency is about 100,000 times higher than the clock rates of contemporary digital electronics, which has been almost stagnating for more than a decade due to dissipation at about 10 gigahertz value. Processor performance was meanwhile mainly driven by miniaturization. Attosecond technology will help explore paths to increasing the clock rates, that's at least what we hope, which is likely to become the major driving force for further advancing processor performance. I guess we all agree that the demand for which we'll never cease. We have now seen how measuring the optical field-induced polarization provides insight into the exchange of energy between light and matter on attosecond to femtosecond timescales. The light electron energy transfer associated with the polarization during the electric field is critical for advancing electronics to its ultimate limit, as I just tried to convince you about. The polarization, nevertheless, may also survive the driving field due to vibrations of the nuclear backbone in solids and molecules. Now, I'd like to share with you how this retarded polarization response in human blood may allow probing human health. Why blood? Because its molecular composition is sensitive. is a sensitive indicator. To actually sensitive indicator of health disease transitions. A fact that is heavily utilized in contemporary laboratory medicine, where referencing the measured concentration of individual analytes to the populational reference range informs on emerging abnormalities. The challenge is actually to find all other so far unknown analytes who would be able to provide very valuable additional information on disease onset out of the more than 100,000 current molecules of blood plasma. Search really literally for needles in a haystack on which tens of billions of dollars is being spent year by year. We propose a different approach instead of searching for yet unknown biomarkers, let's access the entire molecular landscape via field-resolved infrared spectroscopy. What we do to this end is to expose human blood, actually human blood plasma, to be more precise, to a few cycle infrared laser pulse. This pulse coherently excites all infrared active modes of the molecules whose frequency is within the spectral band of the incident pulse. All these vibrations radiate coherent infrared fields in the wake of the excitation. It's much weaker, the excitation, 100 times, 1,000 times weaker. It extending typically over several picoseconds. The resultant signal is characteristic of the sample's molecular composition, which we call the electric field molecular fingerprint of the sample. This very fingerprint can now be directly measured by F-second metrology, in this case implemented by electro-optic sampling. To acquire complete information of the vibrations, their amplitude, frequency and phase. Temporal confinement of the excitation to an interval much shorter than the duration of the molecular signal. The excitation lasts a few tenths of femtoseconds. The molecular signal extends over picoseconds. This temporal confinement to a much shorter interval actually allows us to measure, to access this molecular signal, to capture the signal free from the technical noise of the excitation, which actually limits the sensitivity of frequency domain spectroscopy. Therefore, we expect an improvement in detection sensitivity, and we also managed to actually verify the hopeful improvement in detection sensitivity in a proof of concept study where a small organic molecule was dissolved in water at ever decreasing concentration, and the several microgram per milliliter sensitivity reached with state-of-the-art FTIR spectroscopy could now be improved by almost two orders of magnitude, meanwhile to the level of 100 nanogram per milliliter by field-resolved spectroscopy. The electric field molecular fingerprint of blood plasma is expected to change whenever emerging abnormalities change its composition. This hypothesis could probably be tested with many different conditions, but we initially opted for cancer, which is certainly a very important condition. In cooperation with physicians from the LMU clinics, we launched pilot studies on several cancer entities, including one with the high mortality lung cancer, which I'd like to focus on in hopefully remaining last few minutes. For a case control study, our clinical team, in collaboration with Professor Beer and Co, collected more than 2,000 samples from lung cancer patients and from reference individuals without cancer, either healthy or suffering from an other disease of the same organ. From these, we have selected some 300 case and control samples each, carefully matched regarding the age distribution and in terms of other parameters like body mass index, like smoking habits, and so on. Why was this matching so important? Because we have to make sure that possible differences observed between the case and control samples are not caused by some other effects. We are interested only in differences that are due to the actual condition we would like to detect, which is, in this very case, non-small cell lung cancer. Here you see how the electric field molecular fingerprints of all those samples look like. At first sight, hardly any differences can be discerned, but these come to light at hundreds of femtoseconds after the excitation peak, where molecular emission dominates the detected signal. Before we turn our attention to exploiting differences between case and control fingerprints for classification, I'd like to recall that these continuous wave signals deliver infinite amounts of redundant information. We know from communication theory that any long oscillatory signal can be fully reconstructed by two discrete samples per oscillation period. There are many possible ways of choosing these samples, among which the temporal position of the field zero crossings or equivalent to the half cycle gaps between them appear particularly wide, owing to the immunity to any amplitude noise of the signal. Here you see, hopefully, yes, the mean and the standard deviation of the half cycle gaps evaluated for the 316 cases of stage 1 to stage 4 lung cancer. For the controls, and most importantly, the differences between the two groups. These differences typically amount to a fraction of a femtocent, in some anomalous regions up to a few femtoseconds, centered around the mean half cycle, about 15 femtoseconds. Currently, we extract 400 spectroscopic markers in form of these half cycle gaps from our electric field molecular fingerprints, which we here compare for cases and controls. This comparison yields a set of differences which we refer to as the attosecond molecular fingerprint of non-small cell lung cancer. For efficient classification, the size of these differences should be significant as compared to the spread of references, which is shown here. For stage 1 and 2, this is fulfilled for a few spectral markers. For stage 3, for quite a few more. The new patterns appearing with stage 3 corroborate what oncologists have known for a long time. Cancer is strongly changing with progression. It's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to fight, if not the main reason. This trend continues for stage 4, where metastasis also appear. The extent to which these cancer-induced signals enable detection of the disease critically depends on their magnitude relative to the spread of controls. This biological signal to noise ratio averaged over all markers is called effect size. Its value growing with disease progression provides strong evidence for the measured differential signals indeed originating from the disease. We physicists would probably refer to this as a smoking gun, but I can tell you molecular biologists really don't like this if we physicists say that. So you shouldn't use this comparison whenever you're speaking with life scientists. Actually, before, well, I can skip this. This is just educational to explain to you the final results. So Peter, either I skip this and then I maybe need just 2 minutes. If I explain this, then I need 2 more minutes. So Peter, decision is yours. No, I'm not finished yet. I'm asking whether I have 2 minutes or 2 plus 2 minutes, depending on whether I should explain this 2 minutes. Then I jump over this. I just wanted to explain to you how actually we do the classification. Basically, the control and case groups always overlap here, shown in the on a single biomarker, and basically with the discrimination threshold, we can adjust how well we are able to find the real positives or the real negatives. This is always a compromise because these two distributions always overlap. And actually, the area under the true positive rate and false positive rate, which is called the area under the curve, the EUC, determines how efficient any biomarker, any method is to detect the disease. Obviously, 0.5 is chance. That's the lowest value you can have. And 100%, basically the value of 1 is the ideal case, perfectness. Legally approved biomarkers range between AUCs of 0.7 to, in some exceptional cases, 0.9 and slightly above. Here is the result of our first studies, case control studies for stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, which is quite encouraging. However, these values can get even better. And this is now really important, and therefore I really would say this even if it takes a minute. We have recently shown that infrared fingerprints actually are extremely stable over time for each individual. What does this imply? This implies that we have the potential to improve this without doing anything on our physical method, by just narrowing the distribution of the control fingerprints, which would increase the EUC, as I told you before. how can we narrow this? By not using as reference, by not referencing any individual fingerprint from a cancer patient with a set of other fingerprints from other healthy individuals, but from the same person sampled before he contracted the disease. Because his own fingerprints scatter much less, the within person biological variability is much smaller by a factor of 3 smaller, as we measured it, as compared to the variability of these fingerprints within a healthy population. So that means that if we would replace the healthy controls basically from other person, basically the fingerprints from other healthy controls by a set of fingerprints measured from the same person before he or she contracted the disease, then these values could improve like this. There is no biomarker in sight which would reach these values for early stage lung cancer. What we need for this is we have started doing this here in Hungary just a couple of years ago. We rolled out a population study with 15,000 participants, the Hungary for Health, Health for Hungary clinical study, in the framework of which we follow up these initially healthy persons, which said enough, some of which said enough, over a period of 5 years will contract major non-communicable diseases like lung cancer, coronary heart disease, and diabetes. And as you can now imagine, we will have the fingerprints before and after, and we can test this, what I've just shown you, and test also the same thing for the other two major killers. I would like to conclude by citing someone whom I have very high regard for, Professor Erno Rubik, inventor of the iconic puzzle. In nearly every aspect of our lives, the most important and most difficult task might be to find the right question. Even if attosecond fingerprinting may not live up to our hopes and expectations, this research has helped us pose the overriding question. What is the most economically viable set of health data that enables comprehensive and dependable monitoring of human health, and has motivated us to collect blood samples which may help answer this question, no matter what method ultimately delivers the molecular data. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ferenc. And I think I have only one comment, that now in these days we have all of the hard disk capacity and the computer capacity to follow 10 million people in Hungary. If we would consider this seriously or not, if the medical people would consider this seriously. So thank you very much for
thank
all
you.
Of this study. I hope within years everybody will be scanned and followed, and people just remain healthy, and everybody can participate 10 years from now on the next Wigner Conference 131. So thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak here.